saying that maybe we should start. Maybe first saying good morning to everybody and saying that Honorable Hajjaj will be taking us through the meeting because there is an issue that we need to solve a little bit flexible. Freeline whip, generally no leaves get granted on a freeline whip. But if it's a very, very high freeline whip, even if you are ill, unless you are dead, you may not come here. But then if you can still come here, you still come here. And then die after you have voted. Particularly when it's a constitutional issues. Now today the Minister of Finance is presenting the medium-term budget review, which is quite a serious matter in terms of parliamentary processes. You need a certain number of people. So I will be trying to sort it out with the chief whip's office as to how we handle that part, because it has an impact on us. The first part of the three-line whip will be the parliament will be receiving the World Cup winners. Now, the problem with that is that we are trying to see whether can we excuse from going to the house at that time. That could be misconstrued as not being patriotic. And that's why we need to negotiate and see how we handle that part, so that the committee can proceed and do its work while Parliament does something else. So, hence, Honorable Hajjaj will be then dealing with all the other issues. We shall be going in and out to try and sort out what the chief whip's office is saying and how we negotiate that particular argument. But colleagues, and we've invited people to come and discuss with us an issue that has been with us for, I think this is the third year, if I'm not mistaken. We started this issue in Pretoria, and we had this issue again last year and again this year. It relates to the role that South Africa's business plays in the continent. Remember that we are now the major investor in the continent specifically, not discarding all other investment in other continents, but in Africa, we are the major investor now. In fact, I think we've overtaken the traditional investors that have been investing in the continent. Now, the question of how then do we relate with the continent as we pursue these investments and as we pursue the issue of making sure that those investments pays the dividends that they need to pay, how then do we back up our economic interest with our moral standing in the continent and in the world. Remember that these are conditions imposed on us by the nature of our transition and by the nature of our own engagement with the continent in terms of building peace, in terms of bringing development in the continent. We have said in foreign affairs that at the heart of foreign policy is the continent itself, and therefore that we see the continent as a major driving element in making sure that our own stability and our own freedom is protected. So therefore, South Africa sees itself not as an outsider of the continent, but as an integral part of the continent. And therefore, that our own success are dependent on the success of the continent. And therefore, we cannot see ourselves and our growth in exclusion of the continent. Now, the question is, how then do you build a South African society that takes these values, even in their own engagement of economic activity? How do we translate those political ideas into our daily activities, and how do we build on those political ideals in making sure that whatever we do carries that particular message? And of course, this topic was also raised by the nature of complaints as we interact with people in the continent, how they perceive South African business in the continent. And we felt that it could be important for us to start looking at how we communicate ourselves. Is it the responsibility of government and the Department of Foreign Affairs only to communicate our values, to communicate our own views to the world, or is it the responsibility of all South Africans? And in this case, what is our investing community doing in making sure that we defend our ideals and we sell our ideals? I was once told that any country that goes to war is an indication of the failure of their foreign policy. That when the country goes to war, it is admitting that their foreign policy has failed, because their foreign policy is a reflection of their domestic policy. So therefore it means that if that is the case, we have a duty as a country, we have a duty as individual South Africans to make sure that we promote and we defend our ideals and make sure that we behave in a manner that we are expected. In raising that, we then get told that, no, it's about bottom lines. Anything that does not advance bottom lines is nothing. Last year we had Dr. Mampai to discuss with us, and what he said in his presentation was that in pursuit of a bottom line, it does not sacrifice the values of the community you are investing in, because if you do that, you are going to only go in for a short term. And he was saying to us that as a mining company, their involvement is long term, and therefore whether they will want to have a quick profit and go out is not possible by the nature of the investment that they have to do. So therefore, the interest of the community surrounding them is critical, that for their own survival, they need to take that community into cognizance in whatever decisions they make in the boardroom. So if that is the case, then the question is, what is it that then the South African business communicates to these communities? To what extent do we make sure that these communities become part of our growth in the continent? Because it doesn't help us to mediate for peace, to send our boys and girls in uniform to maintain peace, if we are not able to communicate the same peace in other spheres of our activities. So it means that even at the economic level, we need to be able to communicate the same peace that we seek to restore in the continent. The same development that we argue for, we should be able to promote that development and make sure that that development, the ordinary people benefit from peace, because otherwise they will go back to instability. I was asked some few weeks ago by a magazine journalist as to what was my view about the pending legislation in Zimbabwe on the economy. And I said to a journalist, why is that even an interest? He says, no, why will the Zimbabweans decide to do that now when they did not do it 20 years ago? There's something wrong with this legislation. I said, what is wrong with it? He said, no, it doesn't make sense. What is it that does not make sense? And it says, no, it doesn't make sense to want to restructure the economy and allow people who have not been part of the economy to come in, because otherwise that economy is going to collapse, and the Zimbabwean economy has already collapsed. I then asked whether when we promulgated our BEE laws, were we taking a decision to destroy the South African economy, or were we taking the decision to broaden the South African economy? And he said, no, we're broadening the South African economy. I said, what's wrong then if other people are doing the same thing? Let's debate the approach. If we do not agree with the approach, but the essence of doing that, we should all be doing it. Because if ordinary citizens are not participating in the economy, you are bound to have instability, because they have nothing to lose anyway. They are marginalized. So they have nothing to lose. But if you make them participate in the economy, they have their own strength that they need to defend, they have their own strength that they need to protect, and therefore values of good governance could be built from that. And of course, in that process, there are weaknesses. We have our own weaknesses in our own BEE. That's why at some point we changed it and we call it broad-based, because we're trying to deal with these weaknesses. So in any empowerment that you're going to put, you will find weaknesses. Yesterday I was reading the KWV story as to what are the problems with the KWV empowerment problems, because of the three or two board members that needs to be considered. And those are the shortcomings that always will come into the empowerment project, because we are bringing people that have not participated for quite a number of years in the economic mainstream, and we are bringing them on board to be participants. And in doing so, they bring different values from those that have been participating, and therefore you need to find a way to accommodate those values. And we raised that and we debated that with the journalists on that issue, and I said, I think the whole continent should go the same route. We should seek to broaden the participation of ordinary people in the economy, because that will guarantee us a stable continent. It will make sure that the continent becomes stable, because its citizens are the actual investors in their own economy. We cannot continue to consume what we do not produce. So it means that we must produce what we consume, so as to be able to understand that if we overconsume or we don't produce, we will not be able to consume those goods and services. And we cannot be bystanders on that. And then let's debate as to how we then do those modalities. Now, the question is, will South African business take those values of broadening the participation of ordinary people in the economy when they make decisions of investment? How does those decisions affect their investment in those countries and their competitive edge over their own other investors in that particular area? And because, of course, there are competitive elements. It doesn't make sense for a South African business to get in an environment where the competitors have the upper hand to him, because he wants to pursue a social value at the cost of economic investment. You need to balance the two. And therefore, the question is, to what extent are we South Africans taking those values with us as we invest in these economies? The other issue that somebody raised with me was the quality of the investment that we do in the continent. And that I'll leave it to the guests that we've invited to also look and reflect on the quality of investment that we make in the continent. Is it an investment that will make sure that the continent does grow and is able to be sustainable? Or is it an investment that those who are in agriculture, they'll call it cash crops. Crops that you plant and then they can produce cash tomorrow. Are we making those investments? So that, to what extent do we take strategic decisions to make strategic investments in the countries that we make investments in? Or are we just in the periphery of the real economic entities that exist in those countries? You go to a number of countries. In fact, I was in Malawi recently, and you read the problem that the airline in Malawi is facing. And I'm asking myself, why we've not been able in this continent to build people who have an interest in the air transportation? A European company is interested to move into Malawi. And the question is, why have we not developed the sufficient capacity to take these opportunities and make sure that on one hand we protect the pride of Malawians, but on another hand we make sure that they have dependable airline services, airline that is profitable. You have Air Botswana that is also facing similar problems. And there are issues that go into that. So the question is, to what extent have we been able to develop our own business community to take strategic investment that will ensure that the continent is linked, and it's linked in such a way that we are able to move from one country to another. I don't have to go to Europe to come back to Africa, move out of Africa and come back to Africa. The other time I went to Sudan via Nairobi. On my way back, I had to go to Dubai, from Dubai come back to Johannesburg. Now, it would have taken me about 5 hours to come to South Africa, but going to Dubai is about 8 hours, coming back to Johannesburg is about 8 hours, so it takes me 16 hours to come back to Johannesburg. So I went out of the continent and back to the continent. And the question is, to what extent do we build our own South African business community to understand that it's not only their interest in terms of the their companies that they run, but they carry the responsibility of the country and the pride of the country, and therefore their decisions have an implication for all of us, and their conduct have an implication for all of us. And for them to look at that and say, it's not only about me, but it's about the country that I'm representing. Yes, of course, there are, as I said, that there are limitations. There are these things that are outside the country. Our own companies here listing out and changing their domicile addresses and becoming something else. As South Africa, close to South African companies. I normally call them that because they are no more really South African companies in the sense, because they've moved their domiciles to somewhere else. The question is, how then do we make sure that South African business see themselves as South Africans and they carry the flag wherever they are and make sure that our ideals are promoted? I want to leave the Comrade Hajaj while I'm sorting out the other matter with the Chief Whip's office. But I want to end with a note that said, when I came back and somebody was talking to me and said they had a good celebration in receiving the Springbok team for having won the World Cup. And this person said to me, I noticed something conspicuously absent. I said, what is it? He said, you know, in all the crowds that were there, everybody was wearing green with a Springbok emblem, carrying the Springbok flag. But you can count South African flags. You can count the country flags in that crowd. And then he said, is it about the team or is it about the country? Why we didn't see more of the country's flag to show that this is the pride about the country, that this team represents the country, and why is it that we saw the team flags more than the country's flag? I want to leave it with a thought to ask the same question. What does it mean? What does it really mean? Thank you for the question.
Thank you, Chief Dole. I think we can get on with the business of the day. Mr. Sitole has very aptly outlined what our brief is today. I would just like to welcome the businesses and academia who are going to participate in this morning and afternoon session. I'd like to welcome from Vodacom, Mr. Siyamzashe. I hope I'm saying it correctly. Okay. Well, there should be a CH there, not a SH. Anyway, and then we also have from BHP Billiton, South Africa, this is Ms. Bronwyn Wilkinson, and the CEO, Dr. Mapai will be here, and of course from the Center for Conflict Resolution. We have Dr. Adibajo, Daniel Zimbler, and Ross Daniel. So we welcome you very warmly to this meeting, and thank you very much for making your time available to us. Just before we start, I just want to reiterate something that Mr. Sitole said, and that is, development in Africa is a cornerstone for peace and security. And I think one of the questions that we're going to have to be able to answer, especially at the end of the session, how can we balance our profit margins and the development of the country that we are investing in? And the third issue is, as I said, we wrote this cut back from Malawi. How can we actually mobilize the domestic resources of the country that we invest in. The case in point is, we have just an example, we have ShopRite Games and a couple of other businesses in Malawi. And I went to the local fruit and vegetable market, and I was absolutely surprised, very pleasantly surprised, at the beautifully fresh and good quality fruit and vegetable that was available at the local market. And I then asked the question, how come we are not making use of this resource to actually put on the shelves Malawian products on on shelves of Checkers, whoever else is there? Why are we not using resources that are available in the country? Why does everything have to come from South Africa or elsewhere? So please, from Vodacom, I think we can get moving. I'm not going to take a chance in repeating the name, seeing that I'm saying it wrong. Please.
Thank you. Okay. My name is Mthubi Kiamzashi. I represent, along with my colleagues here today, Phakamile Pongwana and Willington Ngwebe. We represent Vodacom in today's seminar. At the outset, we just want to thank the committee for inviting us to come and share what we have as a company experience or continue to experience in our operations in the continent of Africa, which is where Vodacom operates at this point in time. The topic, as put up there, seems quite flattering, as if we know what we are coming here to talk about. The truth is that without a script, we've been fumbling and finding our way, making mistakes, and trying to learn as we go. In fact, that is the main reason we felt it would benefit us as a company to come and share what we have experienced. Because out of that exercise, we'll probably get feedback, we get corrected, and we'll probably emerge much stronger and wiser as we continue operating in the continent. So we are not coming with any answers or formulas that we think could be applied, but we want to share some of the practical experiences that we have encountered, without specifically saying this one happens in this country, but we are handling them on an across-the-board basis. You may, members, be aware that companies in South Africa, especially those that operate in the regulated sphere, tend to appoint what they call government relations departments, and those departments are normally filled from people who had worked with government before. I think the idea is that these would be the experts that will advise the company on matters governmental. And obviously, the missing link we have as some of those people who find themselves in those positions, there is a gap where we have no place to learn or interact with government about those very things that we are supposed to be advising the companies on. So sometimes we end up saying the things that we think are the things that we should be saying. It is in that context that we are happy to be here today We have a presentation that actually basically outlines bullets. And as a preamble to that, I just headed some aspect of it to put the whole presentation in some form of context. And to start there, I would go and say, doing business in the continent is not an act of charity on the part of businesses. It actually involves huge investments, and I'm thinking about of the order of billions of dollars in investments in capital expenditure and infrastructure. So it is something that there is a lot at stake about. So it is something that is seen particularly in the context of returns to those who put those capital requirements. It is also not something that is done to carry favor with the government of South Africa or government with the other countries. Sometimes it comes because it is a business imperative that whilst we started in 1994 with the mobile sector, it quickly expanded and rose as measured in terms of penetration, that South Africa is starting to be close to saturation level, and therefore companies are starting to look at opportunities elsewhere. And the continent is obviously an attractive proposition in that regard. It is therefore not merely an act of searching for sources of cheap labor or something like that. It is actually something that to survive in the long run, businesses have got to actually contend with the necessities of expanding their business along continental lines. I just thought I should start with what it is not, this investment in the continent, but what it is. It is a business imperative resulting from maturing markets. It is a source of growth which is huge, judging by the number of populations that we have in some of the countries in the continent. It is indeed an opportunity to maximize profit in terms of companies that want to operate and do business in the continent. What one obviously has to contend with in that mix is that those that stay or that have longer staying power are those that live to some kind of rule or code, and they tend to be those that see themselves or behave as a force for good in those countries. By being a force for good, I tend to relate that they become a positive force in terms of the issues that that country is handling. And the presence of that particular company tends to come with it some tangible positives that the country can actually reap. It should be to the benefit of the collective interest and a participant in making sure that the notion that Africa is a sleeping giant is actually advanced to a stage where it is actually a robust and galloping stream of entrepreneurs. It is a demonstration that being African is not being second best. Indeed, some of the innovations that a company from South Africa, particularly those in the telecoms industry, have been able to do, include being one in the Vodafone fold, which has companies all over the world. There are not more than three companies that are doing better than Vodacom in the Vodafone fold. Indeed, the beginnings of what is known as prepaid or pay-as-you-go is a South African innovation. What I'm trying to point out is that South Africa is a serious player and in the cutting edge of all in terms of telecoms the companies that are operating on a worldwide basis. Yes, it is those companies who are able to clear mistrust that tend to be those that survive in the long term, in the long run. We have many numerous examples of how trust plays a part in the way companies are actually seen. It should be a trigger for a skills revolution that individual countries can say, out of all this, we can count the following pluses. It is also an acknowledgement that just as it is not true that a man is an island, it also means no country is an island. It's also a contribution to the rebirth of the continent. Recalling what a minister that I reported to used to say in the old days, that activities that get done should not be like Boswell Wilkie circuses, where today they are here with a lot of activities, and as soon as they go, it sounds like we are visiting cemetery because there has been no meaningful change that has happened. The speech itself is divided in those headings. And the introduction that Vodacom would like to share involves a document that they call the Vodacom Way, which tends to indicate the commitment and the active involvement in the new investment opportunities that come up. From the modest beginnings in telecoms, of 1994, where the kind of forecast that we were giving were something like 500,000 subscribers growth per annum. We are now talking 40 million subscribers in South Africa only. Yes, some subscribers have more than one SIM card, so it is possible that some of those 40 million are people with more than one SIM card. Interestingly, when I visit the continent, I tend to see people bringing four or five phones with them, and they put them on the table, and when we ask, why are you having so many phones, they say, this one is for that operator, this one for that operator. So I don't know if they are able to know which, when this one's ringing, this one is related to that particular operator, but the whole thing I'm showing is the number of SIMs people count. So when we count these numbers, we tend to count SIM cards. Among the objectives we would like to believe the telecoms industry has contributed towards is what is known as democratizing the communications in the country and in the continent. The whole notion was that perhaps politicians would talk about one man, one vote. In ICT talk, we normally talk about one man, one handset. And in that sense, we would like to say we are contributing in terms of these huge numbers, in terms of democratizing the field. It's also an opportunity, like I mentioned, the prepaid business, to actually test the innovative capabilities of the technology that we have. A lot of things that in the past could not be done happen to be possible through the use of cell phone technology. One example I just want to cite and share today relates to the area of HIV and AIDS, where the big problem tends to be adherence to the very intense medication regime that tends to go with it. And what happens is that some of the people, especially those from far-flung areas, would tend to wait until their supply of medication is finished before they go and get a refill. Through some of these technologies, there is a reminder system built on the SMS where actually the phone will tell you, you should now be having 10 pills in your bottle. Therefore, it is time to go and look for a refill before the 10 actually expire. It is something that with an organization based here in Cape Town called Cell Life, we believe reminding people about that responsibility has kind of put cellular technology at the forefront of meaningful things that people are talking about, not just things that will happen in the future. Innovation obviously becomes very critical in the sense that in the continent, we tend to work in areas where there is no infrastructure. If one looks at the DRC, the road infrastructure is very difficult there. You cannot move from one area to the other without flying. Indeed, we found that some relatives living in one area with relatives in another area, they've never met each other any at all. And when cellular technology came, they were at least able to talk to each other. And in when people talk then about the opportunity cost, is measuring the cost of that particular handset with the cost of actually flying to that particular place to see the person. So it is those real-life examples that we would like to be tabling as we move from one country to the other. And that leads to something that the chairperson was talking about when he's talking about empowering locals. And there we are talking about sustainable local partnerships. And I think people or companies would be ignoring those at their peril, because it is those that become properly Mozambican, properly Tanzanian, that will actually survive in the long run. We have had examples that we'll probably share with you in how it is so important to be seen as part of the local network. Vodacom, in its operations, would like to believe that it is reflecting the foreign policy objectives when it says their presence should be used in the promotion of an African continent that is prosperous, peaceful, and even democratic. It is in that context that the issue of, do you take a South African success story or formula to these other countries, or do you try to temper it, to customize it to the local conditions? And that we have learned with serious consequences that local laws are not to be ignored, because you are operating in that particular country and therefore you are governed by what pertains to that country. Issues of reinvestment are issues that tend to be thrown in all the time, that are you here to repatriate everything that you have made out of this country, or are you here to make sure that you have triggered the whole development continuum through your presence, because otherwise you are seen as no different than the whole colonialists in doing business in the continent. And therefore, loyalty does not become embedded in your everyday interaction. Reinvestment, as you may recall, is not necessarily in terms of investing in equipment and things like that. But when we wanted to go to some countries, we were asked, are you going to bring the Vodacom challenge? When you come here, will we be able to participate in the Vodacom Challenge? Some of them would say, are we going to be benefiting from your corporate social responsibility program? So reinvestment takes the form of all those kinds of things. Which takes us to some of the countries. In fact, this is all of the countries that we are present in the continent at the moment. And what you can see from there, that is the map, which kind of tells you that while it is clear throughout you want to have local partners and their shareholding is different from country to country, because it is something that is normally negotiated at the point of signing these agreements. The choice of countries, therefore, is a complex mix of business interests plus government considerations of that country and of South Africa, and the potential of that country, compatibility with that country. So the choice of a country to operate in is really something that tends to be informed from many quarters. Indeed, some of the countries we went in because we knew that at the binational that we have been part of, these things did come up. So it comes from everywhere. But at this point in time, those are the countries that we presently operate with. And as you know, in deciding on countries, things like do we go for one big country or do we go for many, several small countries to make up for that, those become the issue. And it is no secret that we would have liked to have in that list a country like Nigeria because of the population that it has. And it is not through lack of trying that we are not there, but clearly there is something that we are missing because the population suggest that the scope for another cellular operator and that our skills and expertise could actually be placed, being placed at the disposal of such a massive country, perhaps that could display the might of South African companies because you will be having MTN and Vodacom in a single country. I don't know if some of you have seen that now we're in those countries that we participate in, we are in the same country as MTN. They are in certain countries, we are in certain countries. It was only going to be Nigeria that we were both in. So we only are there together in South Africa at this point in time. And it was quite interesting to see what would have happened. And we know they've done very well in the continent. I mean, there's no question about that. But the sense we were saying is that it would be interesting to see how a South African situation is replicated elsewhere. In terms of some of the experiences that we have contended with, basically they are not something that we use to say there's something wrong or something, we're blaming so-and-so, but they really become what we call general lessons that we have learned. And some of them are as real as they are perceived. So as we all know that sometimes perceptions are reality. So really what we try to do there is to say they can be grouped under regulatory concerns. And amongst those, we would count things like sector taxes. And some countries believe that the more they charge on tax, the more they would derive income. Whereas some of the studies from organizations like the GSMA, they would tell you that by lowering some of the taxes on excise duty, you are able to actually have more for government as such. So those kind of differences in stance tend to be the kind of problems we encounter in some of the countries we operate in. Even taxes on handsets. So putting taxes on handsets tends to push the prices of handsets higher instead of the drive to produce low-cost handsets as low as possible. In fact, as far as we remember, the GSM was talking about handsets of the order of $20, and obviously we are still far from that, but taxes tend to be amongst the regulatory drawbacks that we tend to encounter. Others, this one on a government-owned incumbent, is that if you consider a situation where Vodacom and Telkom, with Telkom being on the fixed line, Vodacom on the mobile, the fact that that relationship has not been seen, for example, by the Competition Commission or elsewhere as irregular, is simply because they are operating a separate entity. So you cannot move the cost of one to the other so that you have an advantage on cost. But in other countries, the fixed line and the mobile are one. As a result, when you compete as a mobile company, you are at a disadvantage because you are not able to move your cost in order to be sending a good advantage compared to the other mobile or vice versa compared to the other. So those kind of things are things that have been created by design. And then when competitive forces come into play, there is complaining from our side because the landscape is therefore needing to be made more balanced. And it is something that we tend to contend from time to time. And when we meet those issues, the door we knock at is the government. We say, government, can you help us here? We want to compete as mobile with mobile, as fixed with fixed. Now, while we were thinking along all those things, then came convergence. We start to say, maybe we should look at these things in terms of a technology neutral term. So the issue of the regulatory concerns, compounded by things like many of the countries in the continent tend to depend a lot on consultants. And these consultants would be coming from various countries in Europe and that. And they would advise them that this is the way to go, these are the things to do. And some of that advice is not necessarily appropriate. And they would say reduce interconnection to this, to 10 cents. And you find that because they say, oh, you're wanting to make the cost of telecom cheaper, therefore do this. And sometimes it doesn't lead to that, like in some of the countries they've operated where interconnection is so low, but they have not led to the actual benefit to the end user. So it is those issues around the regulator, as well as perhaps capacity building within the regulator, because you will not have strong market players if the regulator's strength is lower relative to that. So the importance of making sure that the various ICASAs of these countries are actually equipped and empowered to be able to do the job that they are supposed to do in terms of guarding and watching development between with the operator. The issue of political instability or security concerns, whilst not being only an African phenomenon, because you find that in all over the world, but we always have to take the view that it is not whether or not it will happen. It is what do you do when it happens, because you can be sure it is likely to happen, but what do you do when it happens, because when it does happen, we tend to find ourselves being so lonely, not knowing what to do, we rushing to the embassies to say, can we repatriate stuff, can we do this or that, and most of the time you generally don't get the advice that you'd like to get, and in that context then you might do something stupid, and obviously you are seen there in terms of representing the country, and you can't do some of those things. So it is a matter of fine-tuning what happens when we do these kind of things, or these things do happen. So the creation of an environment that's conducive to doing business, as well as by that I'm saying in terms of promoting a supportive environment, which simultaneously perhaps could be discouraging a negative environment or non-competitive or creating barriers, is really what we're talking about under that bullet. On the next bullet, on terms of bureaucracy, we have a lot of examples, and as I said, sometimes we do stupid things. There was some disaster that happened in Mozambique to Vilankulo area, and there we, South Africa, through Vodacom as well, wanted to assist, and something that happened in July last year, to send aid. We were so hyped up to wanted to help, but bought cement, bought things, and we bought them from South Africa. And we asked the Red Cross to help us bring those things across. In short, some of those were only leaving Maputo and South Africa early this year, where the disaster was long finished. Firstly, lessons to learn from that. Why did you not buy cement from Mozambique? Why did you not do this through the embassy? So you start to say, gee, this is not rocket science. You should have done these things. But the way you are thinking at that point in time, you are thinking that you've covered all this ground. So the whole thing of what do we do when these events happen, because they will happen. So it is in that context that we are talking about some of these bureaucracies do need attention. Also, while we are operating in countries that are perhaps having labor-intensive systems, maybe instead of saying let's replace the labor intensive system with automated one, we should not forget that the best manual labor incentive systems do compare with some of the automated systems. So maybe we should strive for better training and more excellence even on the manual system. So where the circumstances that tend to hinder some of our operations, even for existing investors, because we have to go to the countries all the time. We have to not fear that is a problem in terms of going there. And we have to move equipment, because some of these things are not, because of mistrust, say, if you're operating in the continent, you'd like to buy centrally some of the equipment that we'll use in the various countries. And when you start shipping equipment from that central place to the other country, and or then paying back what you are owing in terms of that, they say, but why are you moving funds to that other out of the country? So the whole thing of mistrust comes into play. So it is trading under difficult circumstances. We hope it will get better, but all we are sharing today are the experiences that we tend to encounter. One such example relates to payback cycles. I think the chairman spoke about. There is a belief in those countries that, or perhaps there's a failure to understand that with those kind of investments, it takes something like 4 years to be able to start making out profit. But obviously, because they are part of a company, they say, when are we getting dividends? And they sometimes expect dividends by year one. And they start sending a social responsibility projects before that country is even able to break even. So it's almost like they feel that until it is making profit, it must be funded from South Africa, which generally is not the case. There are exchange control laws. We can't just transfer funds all over. And we generally want each country to be able to generate income to do all its operations from within. And as individuals, we tend to make all sorts of assumptions, many of them wrong, that we know the formula how to operate in Africa, whereas it is never an issue of one size fits all. Every country is different and needs a particular way of dealing with them. And we do make those mistakes through exporting models that don't work, as well as the fact that there's really no manual that you have in joining or wanting to operate in a new country where you can read the do's and don'ts. There isn't. You just fumble your way through until you are able to not annoy so many people. Then you say, okay, that means we are starting to understand how it is to operate in the continent. Countries we know also have their own experiences of South African companies. And I'm sure they can also give a list of the bad practices conducted by a South African company, and some of which are genuine and true. And it's to us, putting those two lists together, we would actually all benefit from such experiences. In the area of the achievements in those countries, we have found that we have been able, fortunately, in the various countries we've moved into, to quickly become in the top three of in terms of market share, and sometimes mostly taking a leadership position. And most cases, we tend to increase penetration manifold within the first 4 years. In terms of our ability to move resources quickly, we tend to be able to have the, what they call first mover advantage over the opposition, because we are able to produce something quicker than perhaps the opposition can. In terms of business as such, countries that were operating in, this current period, the country is doing very well in terms of performance. It's actually becoming the pride at the moment. Tanzania and DRC obviously are countries that the performance is there, is getting better. I think you might be aware of the kind of difficulties that we have had with Mozambique, but we are hoping those will be resolved also. An interesting example to share, we were not seen as proudly Mozambican because we were not doing things that perhaps the Mozambican incumbent was able to do. And the interesting thing that the moment we built a school in Maputo, people started to kind of treat us differently because school is it was something that was urgently required, and you just have to see how they look so well after that school that I think we are easily persuaded to have another school in the north now, because I think I've never seen people taking so much pride in an asset or a building that they've got. It is an example for many of us to learn. And in terms of profitability, dividends in some countries, taxes I've mentioned, social consciousness, I don't think you will survive if you are not putting your technology to assist these countries solve their social problems. I mean, some of them know exactly what their requirements are. DRC will tell you, you don't have to do any research. We want school benches. The more, the better. And whereas if you are some here in South Africa, people will not really be so single-minded about what they need. And to me, it just gives you that sense of pride that they know what they want. If you supply that, that's really what it is all about. And you will remember in another instance, Tanzania also had some disaster, and when we made that contribution, you can just see how they look at you. They see you not only as someone who's come here for business reasons, but as someone who's also going to give them a better life. And obviously, if you don't build that in your offering, you will not have long-term buy-in in those particular countries. Foreign direct investment, therefore, is a benefit or to those countries because it leads to employment, skills development, and general upliftment. Technology benefits clearly are the norm because in DRC, we were using the cell phone, even with their IEC, to help them with the election. And you know how our IEC performed in the elections there. It was partnership through various South African companies, and we were very happy to have been part of that. In Kenya, they even do their banking through mobile phones. They've got something called mobile banking. So transactions are made on the cell phone, and you don't have to go to the bank as such to be able to do that. So being a catalyst for social development to us is really a no longer just a slogan, but it is one of the lessons. Based on what we used to hear from Cuba in the old days, where they say, if you know, teach. If you don't know, learn. So we learn in terms of what we don't know there in those countries. And where we know, we would like to be able to share those experiences with them. Obviously, we try to say we are objective about how we come to decide on countries. And we have our own constraints that we have had up to now, where between the shareholders, we were not able to operate without the permission above the equator. For a long time, we were looking only at countries in sub-Saharan Africa. But things are starting to ease up, and I'm sure many of you are hearing that there is a lot of talk about Vodafone having an interest in acquiring a larger stake within Vodacom. It's something that the shareholders are dealing with, and we generally as management do not get to be part of those discussions or privy to what is being planned. But in some countries, really it's an invitation that becomes the driving force. And sometimes we accompany trade delegations with the deputy president. There are also organizations of chambers of commerce. There's ASCII that invites us to go with them. So there are many ways of getting there. And as much as we say we have an objective way of deciding, the group that follows is just indicators of what we need in terms of making sure it's a cost-effective investment before we even go in. Things like economic value added for shareholders, the risk profile. I don't even want to talk about risk because risk was divided the land even within South Africa not long ago. The tendency is to complement your existing footprint. People would say, if you are in Angola, you are so close to the DRC, so maybe you can, the next one is DRC. Sometimes that is not what the government priorities are, so we have to balance those interests. And how quickly can you go, for example, to 1 million subscribers? Those are the considerations and positive economic outlook. In other factors, bilateral trade agreements, attractiveness of the market, existing competition and population sizes. Those are amongst the things that get factored in the decisions where to invest. What's said is that some countries are the ones who are inviting you, come and invest in my country. And when you look at the figures, you say, you know, it does not give you the sense that you will be able to have a return within your prescribed area. And obviously, if you start rejecting them as well, you are causing problems for yourself, because countries do talk, say, you know, so and so, we ask them. Because the belief is that if you come to me when I'm in need, we will remember that when we are actually having a lot of customers. In fact, some of the people were questioning why we went to DRC when there was war there. But you can see, if those of you who are going to Kinshasa, you will actually see it's Vodacom country. It's all blue. It's precisely because of the appreciation that you came, even when it was perhaps not fashionable to come. Now, when it comes to dealing with you, we're going to deal with you as different from the other. In terms of what we envisage the government role in facilitating this thing, it's starting to crystallize itself these days now that we've been operating. So the promotion of effective relationship between SA business and embassies is quite key. So these trade machines and bilaterals and beyond are quite helpful. For example, we want perhaps to be received by the South African ambassador in that country. He would have an idea, or she would have an idea of the lay of the play in that country, which people to perhaps meet and all that. As much as obviously they don't want to be seen to be favoring this particular company versus the other. But we need to strengthen the link between embassies and the companies operating there. So as well as facilitating through the diplomatic channel security for South African investment, because you sometimes worry, what happens if we've got to go, what happens to the investment? That's why I'm saying it should not be whether or not, it should be what do we do in the case of these eventualities. When those things are known, we will actually operate less erratically than sometimes things tend to happen. So encouraging regulatory best practice, I mentioned that sometimes it's to the advantage of the operators themselves to make sure that the regulator is actually a world-class regulator. Hosting of business delegates from South Africa, providing them generic intelligence information, and lately we were talking to the South African ambassador to Rwanda. We were shortlisted there. He was so helpful in terms of knowing that you guys, you can't try and eat from there. You must come here. When you come here, these are the kind of things that are in the papers here. So we are starting to generate or to get the benefit from that. Similar to the one South African ambassador in Nigeria, it was really very helpful in us even learning the little bit we have learned about that. So the importance of governments in those countries, making sure that we've got some kind of access, because you get very lonely sometimes where you don't know how do I access the Minister of Communication, the President, because there's just no clear-cut way, and yet you want them to know. Sometimes even in instances of disinformation, how do you put your side of the story if you don't have access? So we want those countries or those governments to also understand that it would help for us to have some kind of access. And also to be able to adapt systems and gear them for timeous problem solving, because sometimes we have to wait long for problems to be attended. Not because people don't want to do that, but just that we just need to have someone in that local country, his government, who actually specializes on foreign investors in that country. So we need to develop rules, I'm talking about those countries now, to develop rules upfront that would discourage the probability of failure, because once a company invests, the probability of failure must be very limited, so that, you know, you go in and almost success is guaranteed. There's obviously easier said than done, some of the things, but they would help if at least they are known, because when we say we want transparent decision making, we are not saying there must be no bias in favor of the national. We just want to know how the decisions will be taken so that we see how we can position ourselves accordingly, so that we are able to counter the probability of disinformation. And to that extent, we're suggesting here in South Africa, for example, the embassies of the countries we operate in, if we could form forums with them so that we are able to start engaging them, so that they engage with us, so that it is to the advantage of the investment than any single party. In terms of the last part of this exchange, we are basically saying that through the existing shareholder arrangements, we were until recently not able to operate above sub-Saharan country Africa. The countries that Vodacom is involved in were listed earlier, and though the operations have been largely successful, the kind of challenges we have been with the regulator, because we deal in a regulated environment, things, the pace of effecting things, political processes, and Vodacom believes the South African company can help use their clout, for example, in these countries. I'm sure you are all aware, some of these countries have such a high regard for the South African government. Some of them actually report their government to the president of South Africa and say, we will tell President Begi that you did not do this and this. And obviously that tends to work well for us. In fact, South Africa was saying the government here can play that role because there's been a Rugby World Cup now, of a center in rugby which draws the opposing center so that the wing, you know, has capacity to go and score. So that's really the role that we are envisaging for the South African government. I'm sure you remember that I was in sports in an earlier life. So the promotion, adoption of best regulatory practices is really what we are talking about. Setting up structures to facilitate that interaction, improving service delivery, and sometimes they have requesting some of the companies around that are operating there to be active helpers in creating those systems. So Vodacom actually welcomes feedback on its conduct, because I'm sure a lot will be said against some of the things that we do. But it would be helpful if we could have those so that we can start the cleaning up from our side as well, so that we can actually lead to fruitful operations in the countries where we operate. And I'm talking about some of them say, you know, we've observed you foreign investors that every weekend you go home. You are not seeing yourself as permanently based here. So some of the things that we think are just innocent things are going home, but maybe they are perceived as you are not committing to the country for the long term. This kind of thing that we are sending you for 3 years, for 5 years, I think they are wanting longer term to just to prove your bona fides that you are not there today, gone tomorrow. So we envisage what you could perhaps take out of this, if anything, is that can we start a process of defining what we need to do when these eventualities happen, rather than try to solve things through these exchanges. Once we've got that commitment to do that and sharing these experiences, for example, there's a lot of sharing that needs to be taken just by South African companies operating in a particular country. Where we operate, you'll find that there's Standard Bank and there's Checkers and all, but nowhere do we ever sit together as businesses from South Africa. To end, then, is that we were trying very hard not to be give having or pointing at any blame by any country, because actually that would be immature or something like that. So we thought what for all it was, we have been fumbling, and you can see that we are not coming with any blueprint for anything, but this is how where we are at this present point in time in the country where we operate. As I said, we would like to be in more countries, but I'm sure we cannot do that without some kind of feedback getting back to us. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your very interesting presentation. We are running a bit late, so perhaps I think we should have the second presentation and then open up for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. I think my presentation will be really quite different, because I guess that's why you're inviting civil society to offer another perspective. And I think it can then be a more interesting dialectic discussion once I've given a different view. I really enjoyed that presentation, though, and I learned a lot from it. I thought it was extremely constructive. First, just to thank the members of the Portfolio Committee for inviting me. It really is a great honor and privilege to be able to present before this committee again. What I thought I would do is four things. First is to adopt a historical approach, because I think it's important to talk about what the fears of South Africa are and what leads to some of the perceptions of South Africa's role. And I think it's important to link all these discussions, as you want to South Africa's foreign policy goals on the continent. Second, I think, is to look at post-apartheid South Africa's business role and again link it to its foreign policy goals on the continent. Third, I think a very brief case study of South Africa's role in Nigeria. And then fourth, I think I'll conclude with a few reflections and policy recommendations. And I will stick to 20 minutes or so to be able to do this. So my presentation is titled In the Footsteps of Cecil Rhodes, The Role of South African Business in Africa. Cecil Rhodes, and I happen to be myself a Rhodes scholar some years ago, was the greatest individual historical symbol of imperialism until his death in 1902, sought to paint the map of Africa in the Union Jack of his native Britain from the Cape to Cairo. This ruthless diamond and gold magnate described Africa north of the Limpopo as South Africa's natural hinterland. The heirs of Rhodes, the racist governments in Pretoria, historically saw Africa as an area of penetration, exploitation, and destabilization. From the 19th century, this was the Africa of labor reserves, from which hundreds of thousands of Southern African migrants ventured to South Africa to work in mines, on farms, and in industry for a pittance. This was also the Africa of broken back states, as apartheid's marauding army bombed countries in Mozambique, Angola, Lesotho, Botswana, Zambia, and Zimbabwe in a campaign of awesome destructiveness that resulted in the 1980s alone in a million deaths and $60 billion in damages. And I think it's important to note from this background that it's the collective memory of these actions that are still fresh in the minds of regional states, and that affect also the perception of South Africa's mostly white business on the continent. And I think that's also important to note, the racial dimensions of this business, despite the black presenters, is an important part of the consideration here. At a meeting in Cape Town in January 2004, Adebayo Adeleji, the eminent Nigerian economist and chair of South Africa's peer review process, who presented to this panel a few months ago, ended a talk on South Africa's role in Africa by asking the question that John the Baptist had famously put to Jesus: are you the Messiah we have been waiting for, or should we wait for someone else? Adeleji has been among the few analysts who have clearly understood the damaging effects on South Africa's current continental leadership ambitions of the beggar-by-nation mercantilist trade policies, economic sabotage and dislocation that was pursued by apartheid governments in Africa. Mercantilist states, of course, have historically believed in pursuing policies such as maintaining favorable trade balances with their neighbors, developing agriculture and industry, and accumulating gold reserves. The mercantilist ropes were made to be worn by apartheid South Africa. So we'll return to the question of Messiah or mercantilist at the end of the presentation. In a sense, post-apartheid South Africa is still haunted by past domestic, regional, and external structures that continue to disturb its present. Domestically, South Africa's economy, with over 90% of Johannesburg Stock Exchange still in the hands of whites, continues to be controlled by its white minority, who were the key beneficiaries of apartheid. Regionally, South Africa's control of 80% of the SADC economy and a 9-to-1 trade balance with its neighbors continues to spread fears of a mercantilist ogre dominating the sub-region. And externally, much of South Africa's trade still does remain with Western Europe and Asia in ties established when apartheid's architect believed the country was a Western bulwark against communist infiltration. Now, the term hegemony or leadership is often used to describe South Africa's position in Africa. I think another emotive term, imperialism, may in fact be more appropriate to describe apartheid South Africa's role on the continent. Tony Smith, the American academic, defines imperialism as the effective domination by a relatively strong state over a weaker people, whom it does not control as it does its home population, or as the efforts to secure such domination. This was certainly the perception of southern African states that were economically dependent on South Africa. Apartheid's rulers tied their security to the economic control and military dominance of their neighbors. So just as Mexicans have noted about the United States, Botswana, Swazi, Basotho, and Namibians certainly had many reasons under apartheid to complain that they were so close to South Africa and so far from God. Post-apartheid, South Africa's military intervention into Lesotho in 1998 was justified as a bid to restore order after fears of a military coup d'etat. But the tiny mountain kingdom has a highland water project, as you know, which supplies water to South Africa's industrial heartland of Gauteng. And the fact that the South African soldiers shot their way into the highland water project, killed some of the soldiers that were guarding it, and the fact that this intervention was led by a white military officer who had been destabilizing Angola, meant that there were other issues that were raised in terms of what the strategic motives were for South Africa's intervention. Western imperialism, of course, involved God, gold, and glory, with missionaries seeking to convert Africans from their pagan ancestor worship, with private business interests seeking mineral and agricultural resources, and with empire builders justifying the whole enterprise as a mission civilisatrice, a civilizing mission of savage barbarians. In the South African case, could the expansion of mostly white-led businessmen across the continent represent a modern-day equivalent of a bygone age? Cambridge historian John Seeley had famously said that Britain seemed to have conquered and peopled half of the world in a fit of absent-mindedness, with the flag following trade and the British military and government providing support to the activities of the British South Africa Company and the East India Company. Could a post-apartheid South Africa be forced to protect the activities of its own trade pioneers, such as De Beers in the DRC and Randgold in Côte d'Ivoire? Could South Africa's peacemaking efforts become linked to interventions in strategically important countries such as Congo, in which, as we've just heard, it dominates the telecommunications market, in which its companies control mines, and in which its leaders have backed ESCOM's plans to establish a hydropower project by the 2020s, centered around Congo's Grand Inga Falls, in order to supply electricity to the entire continent? So those are some of the questions that I think are important for us to raise when we look at South Africa's role in business. Soft power, a term coined by the American academic Joseph Nye, represents non-military resources which countries can deploy to influence others to follow their lead and to desire what they want. And Africa's richest country, with about a third of sub-Saharan Africa's economic strength, that's South Africa, could wield these resources in pursuit of its leadership ambitions in Africa. Just as America's Coca-Cola and McDonald's have spread the country's cultural imperialism around the globe, South Africa's fast food chains like Nando's, Steers, and Chicken Licking are becoming household names across Africa as a veritable example of the country's soft power of the belly. Nando's has even gone global, with its chains rapidly increasing in places like London, in a startling example of cultural counter-penetration, where Western consumers have embraced an African fast food product. South African Breweries, of course, its purchase of Miller, makes sure that Africa can play a role as a global heavyweight in the beer wars that are going on, since it's among the top three producers in the world. And ShopRite's 72 shops in the rest of the continent, literally from the Cape to Cairo, because it's even in North Africa, could make it the continent's supermarket of choice. And New Metro has also spread its own cinema to the continent to connect African filmmakers to Hollywood. And South Africa is, in a way, effectively exporting America's shopping mall culture to the rest of the continent. Local resentment, of course, as we know, has swelled in places like Kenya, Tanzania, and Nigeria to what some have perceived as South Africa's efforts to export apartheid labor laws, labor practices, rather, and destroy infant industries in some of these countries. But while South African firms have sometimes behaved in exploitative and insensitive ways, this must be balanced, I think, by the creation of jobs and improvements of infrastructure and services in these countries in Africa. And I think it's important to note also that there has been an increase in standards and the diversity of products that are available to consumers in these African markets. The fact that many of these South African capitalists are white, however, continues to revive troubling historical memories on the continent of a more peaceful but still pernicious invasion north of the Limpopo, using goods rather than guns, as in the past. South African business interests have also sometimes not held their case in the way they've talked about their interventions and interests in the rest of Africa. It's almost as if they want to follow in the colossal footsteps of Cecil Rhodes. Graham Bell of Standard Bank talked of a sense of pioneering. The managing director of ShopRite Checkers spoke of an army on the move, while others have talked of conquest as if Africa were a helpless virgin waiting to be deflowered by rampaging white industrialists. South African firms have established interest in mining, in banking, in retail, in communications, arms, and insurance. It's a very wide sector that South Africa has invested in, often with the active support, it must be said, of the host governments in those countries. And by 2003, South African companies ran Cameroon's National Railroad, Tanzania's National Electricity Companies, and managed the airports of seven African countries. In the same period, ShopRite 72 shops in the rest of Africa sourced South African products worth 429 million rand, rather than buying some of these products in the host countries. It's a point that the previous speaker had made, and you have ridiculous examples of importing eggs from South Africa rather than sourcing it locally. But there has been some improvement in this since that time. By 2000, South Africa had become the largest single investor in the rest of Africa, bigger even than China, and I'll talk about some of the implications of that. Everybody talks about China, but forgets that South Africa is actually a larger investor on the continent. And by 2001, South Africa's foreign investment in the rest of the continent had increased by a staggering 300% since 1996 to 26.8 billion rand. As the excess capital that was built up under the sanctions during apartheid was able to be invested in the rest of the continent. As the previous speaker said, the South African market, which is relatively small, was saturated. And so those were easy markets with quite small transportation costs and things that could be used in the rest of Africa. And by 2002, the rest of Africa accounted for 17% of South African exports, while imports from the rest of Africa was an anemic 3.62%. And it's also important to note that Africa is still a relatively small part of South Africa's total trade. In 2004, 7% of its exports went to Africa and 1.9% of its imports came from Africa. So Western Europe and Asia and North America third are still the biggest trading partners for South Africa. In reaction to some of these concerns, the government of President Thabo Mbeki have consistently stressed that South Africa has no great power pretensions. In February 2000, South Africa established an African Renaissance and International Cooperation Fund to promote democracy and development in Africa. And also in 2005, the South African government started encouraging its firms to develop broad-based African economic empowerment. So just like your BEE in this country, there was an encouragement that South African firms should actually invest and work with local partners abroad. Despite these positive developments, in the minds of many people in Southern Africa, there are uncomfortable parallels, though, between the foreign policy goals of apartheid leaders and Mbeki's leadership role in Africa. Apartheid leaders sought to secure the white state, to promote economic and technical links with their neighbors, and to establish the country as a leading continental power. President Mbeki shares the latter two goals, and rather than securing the white state for apartheid, he's trying to create a state that lifts the black majority out of poverty. In both cases, the principal goal is, of course, to pursue the national interest to benefit specific groups within South Africa. So I think this is important to note. I'll briefly just talk about Nigeria because it's an important market and the relationship between South Africa and Nigeria is probably the most strategic partnership in Africa. I think President Mbeki has also strategically and skillfully used this relationship to build the institutions of the AU and NEPAD and also to promote peacemaking and democratic governance in Africa. And after 1994, South African corporates began to view Nigeria, which has, of course, the largest market in Africa, 140 million people, about four times the size of South Africa's own population. There are 27 big cities in Nigeria compared to about six in South Africa. So it's not a market that South Africa can ignore. MTN and Mnet Supersport blazed the trail and became listed on the Nigerian Stock Exchange. MTN spent $340 million launching its mobile network in Nigeria in 2001 with plans to invest another $1 billion in the country in the next decade. And by 2003, 2004, within 2 or 3 years, MTN Nigeria's post-tax profit of 2.36 billion rand was more than its South Africa, MTN South Africa's 2.24 billion rand profit. So quite incredible return. And MTN had 1.65 million Nigerian subscribers. And it was this success that actually convinced a lot of other South African companies to go into the Nigerian market. Sandvik, Rand Merchant Bank, and Protea Hotels followed. Sasol invested $1.2 billion in Nigeria's natural gas. And the Industrial Development Corporation, this is very important because it's a South African government institution, invested in Nigeria's oil, gas, infrastructure, tourism. So there was lots of investments. Protea, for example, is planning to build 15 more hotels in Nigeria between now and 2008 at the cost of 500 million rand. And by 2003, Nigeria had already, from a very low base, become the third largest trading partner of South Africa in Africa after Mozambique and Zimbabwe. South African investors, and it's important, when I gave a talk in Nigeria last year, I was amazed at how much animosity there was against South African businesses in Nigeria. But South African investors have also complained themselves about some of the problems of doing business in Nigeria. These include corruption, fraud, scams that have damaged Nigeria's international reputation. And they've also talked about the need to supplement power, water, sewerage, telecommunications, and transport due to the dilapidated state of Nigeria's infrastructure. Red tape and too much government involvement, low level of technical skills, the need to pay bribes, delays in getting supplies out of Nigeria's ports also often resulting in bribes having to be paid, a weak judiciary that sometimes leads to the non-enforcement of contracts. And Nigerians, for their part, have argued that South African firms have behaved in a patronizing way, operating apartheid-style enclaves for their staff sometimes. And they've seen South Africans as neocolonial mercantilists bent on dominating the huge Nigerian market and repatriating profits, but not actually opening up South Africa's market to Nigeria's own goods. Other Nigerians have, however, praised the skill and professionalism of South African firms, which they say has improved competition and standards in Nigeria. And Nigerians, of course, have also been the main beneficiaries of jobs created by South African firms. So this is, I think, a very important relationship. There have been some setbacks in the relationships. For example, South African Airways had a partnership with Nigerian Airways that by 2002 fell apart. We've heard from Vodacom, and I would be very keen to hear from them why they pulled out of Nigeria. It's never been completely clear to me, but it was linked to some sort of two of its Nigerian-based executives being involved in some corruption allegations as well. So I don't want to be controversial, but I do want to just push you to say why you're not in Nigeria. Also, this day, as we know, referred to now as that day, collapsed in South Africa after being launched in 2005 with 120 million rand. And so there, in the normal course of business, there will always be successes and failures, and one can't see it as just altogether good. So I think in concluding, one has to say that post-apartheid South Africa is neither a messiah nor a mercantilist power. It's simply an aspiring middle power that is seeking to punch above its weight in global politics. With its own massive domestic problems inherited from the inequities of apartheid, President Mbeki is seeking to reverse these problems through an effective foreign policy. And he's working with other countries multilaterally in Africa. That's the one lesson that I think has been learned from the problems with Lesotho in 98 and General Abacha's Nigeria in 95, that South Africa has to work multilaterally in order to achieve its foreign policy successes in Africa. I think South Africa is also trying to reverse the reputation of being a mercantilist power. The Southern African Customs Union, which has been operated with Botswana, Swaziland, Lesotho, and Namibia since 1919, I believe, has now been restructured to bring greater benefits to those countries. And the revenues of these countries increased from 2.6% in 69-70 to 31.8% in 91-92. And in an agreement in 2002, decision-making within SACU was democratized. And to avoid unilateral trade deals like the controversial one that South Africa negotiated with the European Union in 2000, which excluded SACU members even though the trade deal would affect them directly, a clause was introduced saying that members had to negotiate multilaterally in future. And in 2004, SACU's headquarters were also moved from the South African Department of Trade and Industry to an independent secretariat in Namibia. And I think South Africa is now pushing within SADC to establish a free trade area by 2008, a customs union by 2010, and a common market by 2015. The three main recommendations, I think, for South Africa in terms of business and foreign policy. I think SACU and SADC should be the pillars to promote regional integration within Africa. Secondly, I think a code of conduct would be a good thing to regulate corporate behavior within the continent. And I think, as our colleague had earlier suggested, using the NEPAD secretariat may not be a bad idea to try to develop some of this. And thirdly, I think using local business partners is also important. Sourcing local products, and also making sure that jobs are created and that it's a developmental approach to investment in Africa. And I think South Africa can use the International Development Corporation, which the government basically controls, to be able to do this. I just want to leave you with one final thought, which is the idea of China and South Africa and an economic rivalry could become one of the most important phenomena in post-Cold War Africa. Not many people seem to be talking about this, but I think it's such an important dimension. President Mbeki warned in December 2006 that Africa risked entering into a colonial relationship with China if it continued to export raw materials to China while importing Chinese manufactured goods. And he further noted that Africa could be condemned to underdevelopment if this happened. China, of course, as we know, in post-Cold War Africa, has invested heavily in infrastructure, railways, roads, etc., that many of the West and the Bretton Woods institutions don't want to invest in. And by 2006, China had become the third largest foreign investor on the continent after the US and Europe. It's, of course, been accused of destroying textile industries, even here in South Africa, and importing 80,000 Chinese laborers rather than creating jobs. So some of the similar criticisms of South African businesses you hear about Chinese businesses. And I think it's important to note that the tensions that have been reported in the DRC, where China has recently provided a $5 billion loan in an area in which South Africa sees as one of the most strategic countries in Africa, could lead to economic rivalry and accusations of economic imperialism between both of them. And only 2 days ago, we heard that the China's Industrial and Commercial Bank invested 20% in the shares of Standard Bank at the cost of 36.7 billion rand, that's $5.5 billion. This is the largest foreign direct investment in South Africa's history. It's a very big deal. And I think it could establish a future partnership for the economic domination of the continent, though both rivalry and cooperation are more likely to be the outcomes of the growing relationship between South Africa and China. But I think it's a dimension that we can't ignore when we're discussing this. So I think it's important that South Africa adopts an enlightened policy of developing its region to enhance the country's security, create the viable market for its goods, and prevent a flood of poorer populations arriving at its doorstep. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Alberto, for the very most interesting presentation. I think we should have you more often in our books from time to time. Folks, I think we'll open up for questions now. I think we'll have 20 minutes for questions, and then I think we ought to go for lunch because we have to be in chambers by 2 o'clock. Perhaps Mr. Sithole would like to tell us, Mr. Sithole would like to tell us what transpired about the feline whip thing.
Senator, I'm trying to weigh up the understanding. We agree with the Deputy Chief Whip that will come into the House for 10 minutes and then move out. And I'm just looking at the bell has gone quiet now. Because the agreement was that we'll be there for the opening to go out. But maybe one should take the risk that we proceed and as the Chair, I'll deal with the consequences of not being there. Because I'm just worried that the 10 minutes is going to be very disruptive for us to go down for 10 minutes and come back. Maybe we should agree that we proceed and we'll have to sit down with the equip of the committee and see how we handle the problem that will come after that. But I think we should proceed.
Okay, so questions, I'm sure there are lots of questions. Dorothy? Newa? Defender? Adrian? Okay, come with Dorothy.
Thank you very much, Chair. I will put both questions to both presenters. And firstly, let me make this comment that the presentation as it was made by Dr. Dajo, I think it gives us a big view and the reasons of all the attitudes that we noticed in the continent, and I must say it has been very helpful that you did. And I'm hoping that Chairperson, we will be able to get a copy of all these presentations. And secondly, I think much as I understand the issues raised by Dr. Reed, he has also highlighted a very important side, in my view, because it brought what I could term or what I could call contradictions of development as well. And this, to me, is very, very important for us to pay attention to. Now, coming to Mr. Chamzashi on the presentation on Vodacom. I think the presentation was clear that Vodacom has operated in this, I would say, the English-speaking countries most, except Mozambique. It hasn't done much into the Francophone countries, except the DRC initiative, I think. As he had seen the topic for today, he has shared his experience with their experience with us. But there are a few things which I think didn't come out very clearly. For instance, in our view, I think it was going to be very important to know how Vodacom operates in some of those countries, an example being DRC, and some of the countries that they might be having in plans, for investing in. Because one of the issues that we as public representatives are skeptical about is that in whatever we are doing, we should be able to practice or promote good governance as South Africa, as South Africans. Now, in his input, I think what lacks is the policies of those governments. Because even we as South Africans, I must say, we have to learn a lot on the issues of technology as Parliament, I'll put it that way, because I remember when there was a debate about the SouthAfrica.com, all those issues, they were talking about the domain, and it was something that we don't even understand, some of us, but we had to learn in the process. And obviously in the introducing technology like cell phones and so on, there are regulations that have to be in place in some of these countries. And in the process, what we would like to hear is, were they able to help? Because I think we are interested in strong institutions. And now, were they able to get something from those countries on how they operate, or had they had to develop some policies because there is this technology coming? One of the arguments was that in the past is that in most African countries, if you speak to the minister and you agree with the minister, that is the policy of the country. There isn't any policy existing as such. Now, the second point is the issue of the labor laws. I'm interested in knowing how Vodacom fits into the labor laws of those countries. And lastly, the training. Because I think the training also has a lot even in exposing some personnel from those countries to South Africa. How is the training conducted for those people who are from other countries but working for Vodacom? Is it in the same level with South Africans, or where are they? Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. After listening to the people from Center for Conflict Resolution, I didn't realize you're going to raise conflicts here. But just to add to what you have said, sir, I'd like to make a recommendation, given that I've just listened to you, that Joseph Conrad Nostromo should be made compulsory reading for all Africans in the current context of our growth and development. I think it's a very important consideration. There's one observation I'm making very seriously. The second one is to the gentleman from Vodacom. I think whilst we are educated by your input, sir, I think we have been unfair to you. We should have had Faircorp instead as a corporate body capturing all businessmen. I could understand your own interests. I don't expect you to say anything else but to what you have said. But to the both of you, during the days of apartheid, what we had in South Africa, respectively, role of the state and business as such, an official position. In 1976 and thereafter, we have had what was called the Good Hope Initiative and the Carlton Initiative by both business and state post the burning of Soweto, where business and the state could rationalize its interventions in South Africa, both ostensibly to protect South Africa and to make business quick and make business more businesslike and for it to last. To the both of you, actually, I think you have provoked us. Are you really satisfied that both business and the government of the Republic of Democratic South Africa are at one in entrenching what we consider to be the foreign policy options of our country. They being, in our view, this committee's view, a policy that is rooted in human rights, a policy that is directly linked to and pegged to the African agenda. We are committed to global coexistence, peace and security for all the citizens of the world. To what extent does the interplay of national interests, you have mentioned it earlier in passing, national interests compete with these visions that we have? And the last issue that I want to raise is the historical one, linked to the first statement that I made about Nostromo. Are we sufficiently equipped in Africa, especially us in South Africa, to have a Marshall Plan in comparison to the devastated Europe? Because as far as I'm concerned, if we are going to take Nostromo seriously, and there was a kind of devastation where we were told, take me somewhere east of the Suez with the Anthony laws for us to adhere to, can we really depend on business as it exists today to have the equivalent of what I call a Marshall Plan for Africa, post the devastation of colonialism and apartheid in South Africa? Now, you know, it's a nice term. Ours is not an act of charity, but ours is essentially profit and business. I don't think South Africa is asking to ask for the charity. We have to say from business. We're saying to business, South Africa, Africa in particular, generally, South Africa in particular, are entitled to the spoils already enjoyed, because Vodacom did not exist as an example. Out here in South Africa, it's not a South African product. It is a network, international networking of what your previous, of the last speakers, so the nuances of imperialism. We cannot run away from the fact that our foreign policy options are impeded on by the modernized form of imperialism. I think I have been provocative too, sufficiently. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, I'd like to thank maybe the organizers, in particular Chairperson and both Chairpersons and the WIP, to arrange for us such a workshop. It's very informative to us. But I'll start with the Vodacom. I won't dwell much because my question was covered by Umama's one. But I'll say to Vodacom, charity stands at home. I'm deeply concerned about the role which is played by Vodacom in terms of contributing or plowing back to the people, in particular of the rural areas inside the country. Because I'll put an example, if you go to my province where I'm coming from, you can see there are lots of schools which we have came in wild elephants. Sometimes if Vodacom can come and assist, maybe they can be turned for something else. But then come to Dr. Adibajo. Dr. Coincidentally, I saw one of her booklets during the launching. I didn't go through it. But I wanted to raise some of the concern, because you are, from your own input, you dwell much in the government of the past, in particular on the apartheid. My concern is that, how do you perceive South Africa at the present moment? Because my concern is one, I'm scared whereby South Africa is going to be perceived as an instrumental of imperialism. At the same time, some people, they forget about how we took power. Our plan as a new generation, by then, it was to take the power by the insurrection to the seizure of power. But then the people come and said, no, we want to change. were to have an amicable solution, which is negotiation settlement. Why I'm raising that one? I'm raising that one with an example which you put with Lesotho, because there is a quite difference between policies and intervention. In Lesotho, I thought that we were intervening about to have an amicable solution. But, I mean, your references, it's about old soldiers which were in the past apartheid. You see, that's why I'm raising this thing with that one. And then also, you see, my concern in terms of the language used by the intellectuals, sometimes they don't bring even solution. I'll put an example about the scams. The fact is one, we must clear ourselves with whether there are scams or not. Because there are a lot of things happening in South Africa and elsewhere, in particular in South Africa. And then also, I'll be happy, the last one, the role, I mean, intellectuals are very quiet about the role played by religion. Why I'm raising it, I know that it's very controversial, because there are a lot of activities which are coming up in some countries by the very which are used by vehicles of religion. Why living in our country in the past, we were told that some people were using religion as missionaries in order to pursue their goals. And the last one, my concern is about this. If the doctor maybe can propose to us something, because he was referring about mental style. Maybe how do we treat ourselves with mental style? If you can maybe guide us or clarify us exactly what role must we play. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any more questions? I think we'll just take all the questions now. Because even much time. Majube, like anybody else, I'm not taking questions after that. Mr. Sitole, Mr. Comrade over there. Okay, three more questions and that's it.
Yeah, thank you.
I didn't see your hand, Magata. I said three questions. You're the fourth one. Okay, let's see how we go. Majube?
Thank you, Sir Sitole. I think I'll try to be brief. To Vodacom, I listen very carefully. I'm interested more in their area, in the area of social responsibility. I think the presenter did say something, for instance, about how the technology has assisted on the question of HIV/AIDS. She gave an example. And also the question of communication between among the people of the gay countries, that is the countries where they are operating. But he also, in passing, mentioned something which I'm actually more interested in. And he was saying that the countries in Africa, in terms of the social responsibilities of the companies, they want real practical assistance. He mentioned the question of benches, for instance, in a school. Actually, I'm more interested in that kind of contribution by the companies, because obviously the countries in Africa didn't need that very, very practical assistance. Not that, for instance, the technology is not important to teach, but if you could just give us a few more examples of the kind of your actions and your contributions in the areas of your social responsibility. Unfortunately, there's no time. I really wanted to make a comment on the presentation by Dr. Adebayo related to what Mr. Honorable Sibanye has just said. You know, the question of the comparison, for instance, between South Africa and Nigeria. I think one thing that when you compare the two countries, the area of the extent of colonization of the two countries, I think we must look into that. Not that I'm trying to make any excuses about it, but you see, in countries in West Africa, the white colonialists could not say anything because the climate did not favor them. Secondly, the question of malaria did not favor them. So they did not settle. And therefore, the people of those countries although they went through certain periods of colonization, but it was not as extensive and as deep and as long as the colonization in countries in Southern Africa. And South Africa is one of the worst, because after the colonization by the British, South Africa went through the period of apartheid. Now, I'm saying that unfortunately there isn't much time, so I can't go far on my point, but I just want to say, I think we need to look into those things. And then, as Mr. Subanda said, we must also look at the current South Africa, what we are doing in this current period about, you see, those things that happened during the time of colonization, during the time of apartheid. Are we addressing them, or are we not addressing them? The fact that we have not yet achieved the goals that we are aiming at is another matter. But I think for me the question at present is, are we addressing them or not addressing them? As I say, unfortunately, Dr. Adebajari, I can't go into detail, but I think I would like to engage with you on some of these areas. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. I missed the Vodacom presentation, and therefore the question that I might have been answered through the presentation. But I just want to take Vodacom back to, let's take the DRC, because I spent some time with the DRC, and you can go to Tanzania, Zambia, you look at South Africa's business there. There's a tendency that we are told that wherever we invest, we arrive like the old SADF will do. Kick everybody who's there and establish ourselves and pretend that nothing existed before we arrived. And the question is, what do we do to take the local suppliers, develop them, put them in a situation where they will be themselves suppliers of choice, and not marginalize them and take them out of the business. If you look at home, and maybe this is a regulatory problem, if you look at all the communication industry that exists in this country, the amount of drop calls that happens. And if you have to take that and put it in the DRC, then you ask a question as to what extent do we extract profits in a manner that I would say is not conventional. And the quality of the infrastructure. I was in the DRC during the elections. At least on two or three occasions, we stayed for hours without connection of Vodacom because of one or two problems. I know that it happened here at home, at least twice, and everybody pointed at everyone. But the question is the quality of the infrastructure that we put in those investments. Do we put in infrastructure that only allows us in the shortest period of time to get profits, or do we put in infrastructure that will do exactly the same thing that I heard you saying, that people become nervous if we come in and over the weekend we go home, because that indicates that we are not really committed, we are not here to stay. So are we putting infrastructure that gives that impression that we are not here to stay, and we are just here to get as much as we can and then move out, or do we put infrastructure that will allow us to stay longer? And that relates to other social investment areas in terms of development of economic participation of ordinary people, to make sure that even if it's not directly a benefit to a telecommunication investment, but there will be an indirect benefit given the fact that you'll have more subscribers who will have benefited from the service that you've provided, or a social investment that you've put in place. The last part is the linkages between when you move around the continent. You find yourself in a situation that roaming in Europe is cheaper than roaming in the DRC. If you roam in the DRC, you actually pay twice the amount than if I roam in Brussels. And that tells that there's a problem. It's the same company, I use Vodacom, and I roam with Vodacom, but I pay more if I roam in Malawi with Cell 10 than I would have paid if I roam in Brussels. That is a problem. And I thought that when we invest, we'll then be able to reduce the communication costs. The president has been raising this with Telkom specifically in this particular thing. That in fact we pay twice than in all other developed countries. Is that not also a way of hindering other investments or growing of a country's economy? And Ade, you're raising very provocative thoughts. But what is of interest is, you said in one of your comments that probably Nigeria-South Africa relations are, it's one of the strategic relationships. We had a portfolio committee last time that looked at Nigeria-South Africa relations. What will you play, at what level of strategic level will you play this relationship, given the fact that at some point it appears that there's a hate-love relationship? Take the UN Security Council position, for instance. Both countries have an interest, and these are strategic partners. And the competition between them to ascend to that level, and the attitude of the Nigerians themselves towards South African companies, both in Nigeria and let me expand it to the continent generally. Is it because when we invest, we are not able to develop local talents to take over management? We bring everything from home? Or is it because the way we do business, we are too disciplined, and therefore it makes people uncomfortable in the manner that we do business? What is the real issue that will create resentment? Perception that people dream of, but the real concrete problems that create this particular perception. What do you think that South African business must do or should not do in ensuring that the foreign policy of South Africa informs their investment decisions? That when they take a decision to invest in any country, they look at the South African foreign policy and say, to what extent are we going to be able to implement these policy objectives? Because the environment out there is created by the South African government, whether we admit it or publicly or not. The fact that our foreign policy is such that it creates a relationship with people, it has allowed everyone to invest anyway, being known that it's a South African company, and get a favorable consideration, of course, except Kenya, where there are very serious problems. But those problems are historical also, because Kenya has felt that we are encroaching in the area, in the sphere of influence in the region. So that being aside, what do you think in this case, the strategic relationship between Nigeria and South Africa, to what level does this strategicness go? Is it strategic to a point where one wants to extract benefit from the other? You take Cote d'Ivoire. You take Cote d'Ivoire and what happened to the UN when we're mediating in Cote d'Ivoire. And in this case, specifically by Nigeria's intervention or non-intervention on the Cote d'Ivoirean issue, if you have to go to the UN and see how it plays itself out. To what extent are we strategic? To what extent do we have this strategic relationship between the two countries? And of course, the last question will be this: why did Vodacom really leave the market that is so huge? And when they left, executives lost their jobs. It was not just leaving Nigeria; it was leaving Nigeria, and some heads rolled. What could have been the situation? I would have asked the last question that says: is it true that Telkom wants to move to MTN and leave Vodacom or not? But I'll leave that for some other time.
No. I'm almost covered because my two questions related, one to the social responsibility. Yeah, to the social responsibility. The other one, it was in relation to the labor laws.
Yeah, I'm sure. I think for me, both inputs highlighted challenges for all of us. For the people who are making inputs, for government, parliament, for them, for everybody. I think that's what has happened. My comment would be the inputs have highlighted to me the value of really forging a closer relationship between government, our government and business. That's one. Two, to the business, I think the input also has highlighted the value of different strategic thinking for business. In other words, for them to have a much more integrated strategic planning in their when they plan to invest on the continent. By this, I mean for them to social responsibility as part of their bottom line instead of the examples we have been given of being reactive. Then when people are complaining about schools, only then do you then react and build the schools, and then you see the value of people buying into your investment. But I think what needs to happen, you need to have a much more integrated strategic planning to see social investment as a way of and ensuring sustainable investment in those countries. And then the last issue is, while I see the value of local partnerships, and Vodacom has demonstrated that in many ways, but I think the issue that the president raised in some SADC forum, there is a reality of supply constraints. By local business. That we should be aware of that. As much as it makes sense to buy fruit for checkers in Uganda from local people, but there is the issue of supply constraints. To what extent, what volumes can you buy? Are you sure of that supply? Those are the issues that we need to address at a much more policy level to see how can we help our regional partners and continental partners to deal with supply constraints that they are faced with. And that's a developmental issue. I think it also has come out of this. My last issue to the doctor would be, you mentioned the racial nature of our business, which is correct, and you gave the statistics. But my question is, how do we then deal with this issue? To ensure that NEPAD is driven by the ownership of this development in Africa is actually owned by Africans. I don't have answers about that. I would like to hear from the intellectuals how do you deal with this issue.
Thank you. I think to business. I was concerned to hear that business does not come together. You know, that you guys can say there's no forum. That's where they are acting in concert, you know, in their approach to, you know, to the continent. And I think that really I regard that as you know, rather serious matter. That ought to be taken seriously, and such a forum perhaps needs to be created as soon as possible. And then the other, attention to you, Dr. Ade Bajan. Yeah. I think it has been expressed by some, you know, by a number of MPs who have spoken now, but I also want to underline that and say that perhaps it just does seem that we are in that difficult situation where we are judged very much by the past of South Africa, rather than what the present
government of South Africa is trying to achieve, you know, in first within the country and in the continent. And how we can get that, you know, to operate. But I think it's people like you who are in your position of, you know, interacting with Africa and the community writings and everything academic, who really can address that matter with the reality that it deserves, because there's no point in judging us, you know, with the force of a party. And I think that also, I just want to underline that South Africa is very sensitive in its interaction, you know, with the continent. And I think that that needs to be assisted, you know, by making sure that there is a kind of really realism about how people view the government of South Africa. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd just like to ask a very short question. I'd like to know whether business actually looks at the NEPA programs of the region when they're doing this, and do they take on board the Millennium Development Goals? Because I feel that there must be some kind of bigger strategy when you invest in a country or a region, because you are operating within a framework of an African agenda. So I would like to know whether the business actually does take these matters, or at least discuss these matters at all. Before I ask our visitors to reply, please, it would help if you put into perspective your answers in a way forward, because that is the last item, and I don't think we have time to take that. I think it should be part and parcel of the answers, if you could help with that. And we would appreciate your paper from Vodacom and from State. Oh, we'll have to. Okay, fine. Thank you very much. Please go ahead.
The first question was about, I think the one was a comment about Francophone absence. We concentration on English speaking Africa. And I did answer that. I said the earlier constraint was to deal with business sub Saharan Africa. So I thought that was. The other point was something that was not clear was to do with the policies in terms of for good governance, where policies of government, were they able to help develop policies. That's another point we addressed a lot, because I alluded to the regulator in all our saying that a strong regulator is obviously good for the operators themselves. So I was talking about a capacity building within the regulator. And for example, it's not something that a single operator would be able to do that, as the second comments were coming. Maybe you needed to talk to a broader business grouping to be able to get the kind of comments answered that you were looking, because we were invited as Vodacom to talk about Vodacom experiences. We can't say we're representing business, because that would not be correct. Issues of labor laws, the labor laws, when we employ people in the country, is in terms of the laws of that country, we don't employ. Only people that we bring in are what we call the secondees. And in that country, they are dealt with as that country, whatever allowances they are entitled to, because they are in South Africa, is something else. Because when you are seconded to a different country, you are entitled to an allowance for being deployed elsewhere. Training conducted to the same level. Training is normally tailored to the particular requirement. And if one requires more than the normal, or if one, so it is tailored in that regard, because it is something we cannot keep on training, because we've got an interest in someone being able to deliver effectively. So training is something that kind of dependent on the level and the development stage of those people. Otherwise, training is something that, in terms of even the South African laws, we've got to commit X percent of the payroll towards training, and they get audited on those things. So training is something that we cannot go without. I think the other question then came from the point that we should really have got a business representative grouping, and the questions that were posed of role of state and official position. Are you satisfied with entrenching foreign options and human rights, African agenda, sufficiently equipped for a Marshall Plan, and can we depend on business, not asking business for charity? To me, those questions are obviously questions that we as individuals, like I said, companies tend to recruit from what they think is a knowledgeable pool of people. They tend to say, let's recruit from government, let's recruit from there. So the whole idea is to be able to get the decisions informed so that they make applicable decisions. So as representing the company, I wouldn't be able, obviously, to respond on that because I don't have a mandate beyond Vodacom. So that is, I will leave that one at that stage. A lot of questions were asked about social responsibility and charity begins at home, rural areas, integrated plan, and reality of buying constraints. So basically, in terms of social responsibility, an example, it is actually one area that Vodacom does very well in its social responsibility. Actually, an area that happens to be headed by myself at Vodacom. And if you look at ratings, we are number two in the country consistently. So I suppose it is incumbent upon me to talk about these things that we do in social responsibility. It's done in two areas mainly, education and health. And in that score, we look at things that are related to poverty alleviation, and on other side, things that are related at utilizing technology to solve social problems. Every year, we build jointly with the Department of Education a school in each of the provinces. It's happening every year. Free State, we build two schools. The next one, Northwest, we just built two schools. We are now talking to the Eastern Cape. So what I'm saying is that that is one thrust of the thing, is the building of schools to complement the Department of Education effort. We started with Bizana in the old days, and we've always been building a school in trying to do it in the disadvantaged provinces. Secondly, every year we give out 50 bursaries for tertiary education for electrical engineering, accounting, and IT, because those are the skills that are considered to be scarce skills. So we do that annually. If you count how many we've had since we started, I tell you it is several thousands of people that have benefited from that. And in still in education, in terms of the training of teachers, that's the trust that we put, is to actually help teachers in the effect we... We have collaborated with the NBI Education Alliance. Just to give you an indication, we built a school. When we realized the school was not doing well in matric, we appointed teachers to help the school. The passing mark moved from 19% to 54%. It's now at 85%. Then we say to the Department of Education, does this model work? Don't you want to adopt it? So what I'm trying to say, social responsibility is one area we focus on. Now, in education still, beyond that, we help school government bodies because
school governing body is a critical component of the governance of schools. What we cannot claim to do is to be at all the provinces at the same time. That is obviously not happening. But we try to follow a particular logical order that a province must get something from us every year. That's really how we handle it. If you look in the area of health, we've just funded now the 1,000 patients, elderly person, to get eyesight back through the cataract operation. We've done 1,000 now. We've done cleft palate, we over 500 people have been given cleft. They are born open, you just sew them. We fund those kind of people. In health, we mentioned the one of HIV and AIDS monitoring. So the whole trust now is, how can we use technology to solve social problems? Like in the area of preparation for exams, what can we do using technology so that people can be able to either share the same? You see, other people are in different areas. They don't benefit from the quality of education in the rural area. So the whole idea is to ensure that they are having access to the syllabus irrespective of where they are. So in terms of the level of expenditure in terms of social responsibility, this year the budget is 75 million rand. It's divided into those things, and it works out to be a certain percentage of the turnover of the company. That's why it's not stationary. It goes with the turnover. And in any case, where you spend is governed these days in terms of the scorecard on the BEE. It actually says if you spend in these areas, this is the way of getting maximum points. It's obviously a pity that not everyone is aware of the work done in social responsibility, but even the publications that we do, we don't report ourselves what we do. We get the communities with the beneficiaries to say what it is that actually their lives are changed. I'm not going to talk about feeding schemes because those are ongoing things that you just have to manage. Remember, in social responsibility, if you get involved in a feeding scheme, it's almost a permanent thing. You can't go out because what will they eat if you withdraw? So you go on. So I'm trying very hard not to feel surprised if people say, why don't you eat enough for social responsibility? Because it's driven by me, and I definitely want to make sure that it does the uplifting that it is intended for. In terms of the balance of the questions do we behave like SANDF when we invest in the country, as if the local suppliers have not been there? I think that one was actually answered about in terms of reality of supply constraints in terms of when you are looking for a supplier, you're not questioning where do you come from. You are actually saying, what is it that I can do, where I can maintain a certain level of quality, because the same speaker was asking about quality. You ask about the level of quality so that you are able to. You are not going to order something from South Africa when it is done, you know, you need it in Nigeria, because it's going to cost you more. So the issue of local suppliers has those kind of safety mechanisms to make sure that you use them. But obviously, the reality in telecom that some technology is available only in certain pockets, which you will buy from, like in base station. You're not going to find, even in South Africa, local suppliers. You're going to have to find them from Ericsson, from Siemens, or something like that. So it is determined by the nature of of that. In fact, the very BEE charter which we are talking about actually penalizes you from buying something elsewhere when you should buy it here. So you have that negative reinforcement anyway, and we are talking huge amounts when it comes to the technological equipment. So in terms of that local, things like drop calls, we get called to Parliament by the Department of Communication on an annual basis to come and account for drop calls, tariffs, even network quality. And we answer those things that Yes, drop calls are a phenomenon that happens. But if you bring a guest here from London, you travel the N1 to Johannesburg, they tell you, I had this call, it was never interrupted, and all that. So what I'm trying to say, it is a function of many things, whether you will drop calls. The question is, it's a matter of spectrum, it's a matter of topology, it is all sorts of things that you factor in that. I don't think there's any operator in the world that will say there will be no drop calls. Actually, I mentioned earlier that in terms of Vodafone affiliates of operating companies, Vodacom operates in 186 countries worldwide. Vodacom features in the top three in terms of quality of service, grade of service. It is that. And we can never relax on that because that is the... It's a point of competition. If ours are being dropped more than the competition, so it's never we can relax in terms of that. So all the time, it's a matter of the spectrum. Some you can have intended for long distances, some 900, 1800. So that's why when you give a spectrum that is suitable for long distances, or so it is something that actually makes telecoms exciting because it is a matter of trying to redirect these challenges faced by drop calls. But it is a phenomenon that will be with us as that. But now that there's number portability, it is in your interest to keep your subscriber. So you won't negligently leave things because you're going to lose business. So the whole thing is that the fact that we are 58% market shareholders does not mean that we are without any of those things. But it's just that we are probably able to adjust systems to be able to accommodate that. In terms of roaming, I'm glad that you just come in now, but roaming is something that is actually getting cheaper and cheaper in the sense that you cannot afford to have roaming as an issue. I know Paggy can add on that one, but roaming is a function of something that is actually more downward than that. Not for any reason, it's just that the trend is to actually get that to be less of an issue now than it has ever been, because you want to be able to, it's a matter of negotiations with several networks all over the world. But the only thing is that in fact just to have to give you some comfort, the way technology is evolving now is going to be such that the phone itself is going to be able to choose the cheapest at any point in time. It's going to say, given these people, this is, I'll use this one, and I'll not use that one. That is where things are going. So low cost is actually going to be the name of the game. But as a company, it is something that we have to continuously monitor. And until there's probably one day where there's no roaming charge, if that is possible, I mean, this thing will continue to happen. Roaming is obviously the fee that you pay because you are using other people's networks. So it is, we have all sorts of innovations like Vodafone Passport that you are charged at the rate of just if you are at home. It's just everyone is trying to bring it down. It is something that is acknowledged as a factor in the mix of prices of telecom. And on that issue of prices of telecom, right now, the Department of Communication is filled with proposing something that is how far will the operators go in terms of that. They have chosen to look at what we call mobile termination rates to lower those. It is something now they are hearing or with ICASA. So the whole thing is when does that process come to an end? So it is something that is on end. The issue of forums for collective business thinking is that we have established one for the countries where we are operating in, and we are not sure how good it's going to be, but we hope it will. and the last question related to NEPAD and MDG. Obviously, it is in the interest. You see, companies who are doing things in a subjective way, they are only going to be successful this year. They won't be able to be successful in the long run. So it is to factor as many conditions as possible when you are making these investment decisions. Incidentally, in the slide, we did put what we look at in terms of investing, and issues like NEPAD were actually part of those. We did not specifically put MDGs, but the reason why companies are wanting to recruit people who know about these things is precisely because of the recognition that they need to factor these issues here. In terms of the overall questions that have been posed on me as a Vodacom representative, obviously they did come as a surprise in the sense that my invitation was clear: you come and tell us what you are experiencing in terms of these countries. And had I known that we want questions on network, on labor relations and all that, perhaps a different question would have been sent by Vodacom. But we got a request, you do this, and we assume that it's a nice opportunity to be able to interact. And it is in that spirit we came, and it is the very reason why I said, I got no formula of doing these things. We fumbled our way to where we are, but we will share with you what we are encountering so that a process could be started that would lead to a better ordering of these issues. We didn't know that we were going to be in the ring and that because, as a former chairperson of Boxing South Africa, I have brought my gloves. Thank you.
So we still don't know why Vodacom left Nigeria, but I think that it's out of your area of operation. I think Honorable Sithole knew he was taking a risk when he invited me, and he's often told me that civil society should not antagonize or provoke honorable members. So I think I've appreciated the exchange here. I think in terms of Joseph Conrad, the heart of darkness, and Chinua Achebe's very famous critique and demolition of it should also be added to the reading list like you suggested. What are business and government doing in terms of foreign policy? I think government and business, or how are they similar? How are they working together? They're at one in wanting to grow South Africa's economy and improve the lives of people, of course. And I think in an abstract way, they're also both seeking to improve stability in Africa. But I think all capitalists everywhere behave in similar ways, whether they're South African or American. And they do want to increase their market share. They'll destroy the competition if they can. And I think you can confirm that. And they'll create monopolies where they can as well. So I think we shouldn't be naive about that. And one of the things I liked about the presentation was that he made clear they're not doing this for charity. So I think it's important to note what the interests of business are. But I think what we're trying to say is that business needs to be smart about how it defines its interests. And if by building a school you can get more stability and more goodwill, it helps you to actually increase your profits, and those are the sorts of incentives we need to be able to provide as well. But I think another thing is we also should not let off the hook the host countries. A lot of these African governments, they have to be the ones that negotiate properly, not just with South African companies, but with Chinese. You know, if they want to bring in 10,000 laborers, it's up to the African government to insist that you use local labor. So I think we shouldn't just put the responsibility on South African companies, but I think it's important that the host governments themselves have to be able to negotiate in a way that promotes their own interests. I think the government of South Africa is actually more sensitive than businesses in terms of the past of South Africa, and some of that history
historical baggage. And the government obviously wants to play a leadership role. It wants a stable Africa in terms of not just the market for its goods, but also in not distracting investment from South Africa. It's often said that the instability in Zimbabwe often affects the way that investors view South Africa, because of course some of those foreign investors tend to see us in an undifferentiated way. So I think government's interest tends to be a lot more focused on these sorts of issues. The Marshall Plan I don't think is really going to happen. It happened in Europe under very peculiar and idiosyncratic historical circumstances, and happened in an area in which there was education and they were able to absorb the funds. I think what we should push for more is to cancel the $290 billion debt that Africa has, because it's clear that it won't be repaid. We paid back between 1970 and 2002 $550 billion out of the initial $540 billion. And I think there's a moral argument to be made that a lot of these debts were accumulated by dictators like Mobutu and others, that the givers of the aid knew were actually embezzling the funds. So I think I would rather focus on getting the debts cancelled as a first step in terms of Africa. And then I think some of the questions that I got from the honorable members on South Africa, I think I don't want you to get me wrong in terms of South Africa's role in Africa. Post-apartheid South Africa has played an extremely important role in Africa. You've sent 3,000 peacekeepers to Burundi and the DRC. You have peacekeepers also in Ethiopia, Eritrea. You've contributed to a lot of the peacemaking in places like Cote d'Ivoire and the other places I've talked about. And it really has been a lot of very heavy investment of time and resources. So I think that's something that one has to note. And in a short decade, South Africa actually went from being the greatest destabilizer to being the most active peacemaker in Africa. And I think that's something that we recognize. In fact, this book, which I think Honorable Sithole has made sure that all of you have, is the first book to comprehensively assess South Africa's role in Africa over the last decade or 13 years or so. And it really does try to tackle these issues and look very objectively at what South Africa's role is in Africa. It also has a diversity of views in terms of the people that are there from Uganda and Nigeria and Lesotho, so that you have a view of what others think about South Africa's role in Africa. And in fact, there are major concerns that when President Mbeki leaves in 2009, we're not sure whether the same level of commitment will be maintained to Africa as he has maintained, because he lived in Nigeria, he lived in Tanzania, he knows Africa well and is quite committed. I'm not encouraging a third term as president or anything like that. But I think it's important to note that a lot of what has been done, a lot of what has been done in Africa is important. But I think you can't separate the past, though, from the present. And I think the government understands that. And I think as long as you have a situation where whites are mostly in control of the economy, where a lot of the intellectual output of the country is done by whites. You know, 70% of the faculty at many of your main universities are still white. UCT has just appointed a white vice chancellor. They see nothing absolutely wrong with it. And most of the companies that are going into the rest of the continent are white. I think this is what continues to raise questions in some minds, that is the black government really in power, or is it merely in office? And I think that sort of domestic transformation needs to be accelerated. And I'll talk a bit more very briefly on how I think it can be done. In terms of South Africa and Nigeria, Kwame Nkrumah, Ghana's first president, once said that a statue should be erected to the African mosquito,
because that's what saved West Africa and a lot of the other parts of Africa from white settlers on the continent. Of course, South Africa and Nigeria are very different in terms of how they've operated. And I'm even more critical of Nigeria, being a Nigerian myself, than I am of South Africa, because despite apartheid not having been in Nigeria, you have completely dilapidated infrastructure and a country that really should not be where it is, considering its very impressive human and natural resources. And so I think visionless leadership, corruption, etc., are things you certainly want to avoid going forward, because they've really taken a toll on Nigeria. The strategic partnership between South Africa and Nigeria, I think it's the most important partnership in Africa. And I think without both of them working together, you're not going to really get much. Half of sub-Saharan Africa's economic strength is based on these two countries. They have two of the strongest armies, and without them, you would never have got institutions like the AU and NEPAD, and they're the backbone of both SADC and ECOWAS. So as they say, when South Africa and Nigeria sneeze, Southern Africa and West Africa catch a cold. They're that important. They account for about 3/4 of the economy of both of them. And I've been told, I'm not married myself, that like any marriage, there will be disputes. But I don't think divorce is an option in the relationship between these two countries. And even though you have had some differences on the UN, on the AU, and these sorts of things, I think these are things that happen in the natural course of a relationship between countries. Yeah, it's how you resolve it that is important. Just as I've talked about South Africa and China, they can be your largest investor one day, and then they're giving you trouble in the DRC the next day. And it's how you manage those sorts of issues that I think are the problem. In terms of some of the remedies, I do think that having more Nigerian managers at senior level in South African companies is important. I think more local partnerships and ownership is important. And then I think also trying to diversify the trade of Nigeria. 98% of Nigeria's exports to South Africa is still oil today. And I think if that can be diversified, it will lessen some of the friction in the relationship between both countries. And the final thing is you must stop seeing all of us as drug traffickers, and that could also improve the situation as well. It's still happening, though. I think in terms of the issue of race, this is my last comment, Chair. Black economic empowerment and making it broad-based is extremely important, I think, in transforming both the image of South Africa and the rest of the continent, and given a stake in the economy to the majority of the population. It's absolutely essential that that is done, both for internal and external reasons. And I think my last point is that in the short term, there are lots of Africans like myself who were part of the brain drain in the West who could easily be brought back in terms of the skills shortage to contribute within Africa itself, until you actually have the locals that are trained to be able to take over those positions. You create a brain trust that is Pan-African. You help to convince South Africa of its African identity. And I think you also provide role models and mentors to black South African students and others that are coming up the ranks. And so I think that's my last comment, Chair.
Thank you very much for your reply. We do appreciate it. There is lunch waiting outside. And so before we all go to plenary, please help yourself. Once again, thank you very much. It's been a very constructive dialogue. Thank you.